everyone. For today's podcast, I will be joined by fellow widows that lost their spouses to COVID, along with Rosie Davis, founder of the Yellow Heart Memorial, remembering those that passed from this illness. Last week on March 13th marked the four-year anniversary of the start of the pandemic. I know it drastically altered our lives. I never imagined in March 2020 that 18 months later that my late husband Keith would be gone and be part of the 1.1 million statistic that was highlighted by the media over and over. Unlike other grief, COVID widows endured a traumatic experience in a very polarizing environment where the mention of COVID sparked some form of debate on political scrutiny, healthcare policies, economic impact, social distancing, masking, and vaccines. Our loved ones' losses got caught up in all this noise. When I look back at the entire experience from the time we got to the hospital with my husband to the day that he passed, it was absolutely awful. Just awful. I know that others had a much worse experience, especially early on in the pandemic, where the loved ones were completely left alone in hospital rooms. As a society, we completely cut off those individuals that were sick with this illness to die in hospitals alone without their family. So today's podcast is a focus on remembering our loved ones that passed from COVID so that they are not forgotten and to also not forget those left behind. That's why I titled this podcast, The Forgotten COVID Widow, because we need to have a conversation on how we as widows process the grief in the midst of a politically charged environment. Jennifer Clark, Leah Johnson, and Rebecca Hulquist will highlight how they coped, how they were supported, and how they managed to survive. That's some of the things you will hear today. Rosie Davis will highlight her work with the Yellow Heart Memorial to keep our loved ones' memories alive so that they're not forgotten. If you have any questions on today's episode, reach out to me via email at widowsthatwine@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Joining us today, we have Jennifer Clark, Leah Johnston, Rebecca Hulquist, who lost their husbands in 2020 and 2021. We also have Rosie Davis, who lost her mother to COVID and started the Yellow Heart Memorial to remember those that passed from this illness. We all share one commonality in which we want to make sure that our loved one is not simply a statistic of the pandemic. They were more than a number. One thing that I've learned through widowhood is that people are afraid to speak our loved one's name for the fear that it'll trigger us. We love to say their name. It lets us know that they're still thought about and that their memory lives on. So I'd like to introduce everyone and start with actually with Jennifer, Leah, and Rebecca, and have you share your spouse's name and a favorite memory about them before we start today's discussion. So I'll start with you, Leah.
My husband's name was Charles Richard Johnston. We lost him to COVID on January 12th of 2021, which also happened to be my daughter's birthday. So it was a double whammy. You know, everything about him was, he was truly a man of God. And yesterday, as I sat and looked at cards and stuff again, because I was cleaning up my room, reading the things that people wrote about him, you know, I think those are some of my most precious memories, is the memories other people have of him also, that it wasn't just in my eyes. I thought he was a special man.
Thank you. And Jennifer, what about you?
Right. My husband was Leroy Clark Jr., very important for the junior. He died from COVID on September 24th, 2021. And he was a kid at heart. That man, no matter how old he was, he still had his Hot Wheels. He still had all of his collectible figures. That is just, I will never forget that. I have a whole garage full of it, but that is my, that's my memory of him. He was always a kid at heart and lived every day like it was his last.
What about you, Rebecca?
My husband was David Eugene Holquist, and he died on December 12th, 2020. And a few days after our 27th wedding anniversary and his 61st birthday. And one of my favorite things about him was he's a musician. He was very good at a lot of instruments, but he played the guitar very, very well. And I used to love watching him. A commercial would come on TV and his guitar sits in the living room and he would just pick it up. And by the end of the commercial, he could be playing whatever music was with it. So he had such a great air. And then I would just sit at him looking at him and swooning, you know, like, oh, he's just the best guitarist on the planet. But he wasn't, but he could just pick that up and play it, you know, all the way through and just play by ear. And I just used to admire that so, so much. I love that. I miss that. I, you know, nobody can do that for me again.
I appreciate you all sharing that because that's such a good way to remember them and just also highlight they lived, right? They gave us such incredible memories and incredible experiences. So I'd like to, and I know we're going to have Rosie talk in a little bit too, but I'd really like to kind of start the premise of, and it's kind of like reflecting back during that time in early 2020. I mean, we kept hearing about all the different testing, right? The PCR test, this and that, and then the different COVID tests. And, but then it hit home, right? For us, what was your initial thought when you found out that your spouse tested positive, right? What kind of set things in motion? Because there's all this other context going on. And now you're going, oh my gosh, it's here, right? What were your thoughts about that when you first found out?
Well, I go ahead.
You want me to, yeah, just my whole house was sick. My daughter's boyfriend at the time, he didn't know he had stopped by the house. You know, everyone had their little inner pod of people, you know, that you were safe around. Excuse me. And he went home and then never came back. Like he was isolated. Then a few days later, my daughter started feeling sick and tested negative. And then a few days later, she's like, I'm sick, Mom. I better go again. So we drove and did the test. And then I could feel a little tickle in my throat, but I didn't do anything. She tested positive, got horrifically sick, GI. Then 2 days later, I got sick. This was all before Thanksgiving, like around the 18th, 15th of November. And I ended up getting pneumonia really bad. Both of us were taken away via ambulance and I was scared to death because I thought, oh my gosh, don't let me be one of those ones. My pneumonia is so bad. I'm not going to come home, but we both came home with medicine, et cetera. And then about five, 6 days later, and we went right to our bedroom and stayed there. 6 days later, my husband was like, I got a headache. I don't feel good. So he took my 17-year-old at the time. They got tested. My 17-year-old was positive, never had a single thing, nothing. And then David came home and he started getting sicker and sicker. And we checked his, yeah, it just, it snowballed from there. And when he got positive, I now thinking about it off and on, I think I put it in the back of my head, like, oh, he's positive too. Like there was two parts of my brain going, thinking how this could end, but not really making the thought official. I was like, oh, like I could see myself thinking this is bad, but I didn't. Like I held it back. Like, oh, okay. Well, we all had it. And then I was just like, he's going to be fine. He's going to be fine. Total denial. Like this is, oh, well, we're fine. We're fine. Yeah. I couldn't even think, you know, especially how sick we had all been. I mean, the paramedics had been to our house, you know, two times already. So yeah, no, I definitely was in denial. It was, yeah, weird, really weird.
What about you, Leah?
Well, I had taken three of the grandkids up to our house in Utah, and we got home on either a Monday or a Tuesday. We got home Monday, and my niece, who was living with us at the time, said, Uncle Rich didn't sound good this weekend, but he seems to be okay now. And he went out and he met with the pastor like he does every Tuesday, and they walked the property and prayed, and he came home and they had plans to go down. We run a food pantry. and they had plans to go down to Riverside to pick up food. And he woke up Wednesday morning and he's like, you know what, Leah, I'm just not feeling it. I can't do it. And so he crawled back into bed, and for him to go into bed was not normal for him. And on Thursday morning, he was running a fever, and we found a place that was testing. So him and my niece and my daughter and a couple of her daughters went and got tested, and they all came back positive. We got the email the next day, they were positive. And I remember he just like would lay in bed, and he wasn't really hungry. And I made some soup one night, and he was sitting in the chair watching the Steelers, because he wouldn't lay down and watch them. And the next morning, Sunday morning, his breathing was just not good at all. So my youngest daughter came over, and she like begged him, go to the hospital. And he's like, no. And she said, what would you tell me if it was me? And he said, I would tell you to go, but you know, I've lived a good life, and if God wants me, he's going to take me. That's exactly what he said. But she finally convinced him to let us at least call the paramedics. So we called the paramedics. They came out and saw him. He had a CPAP, so they put his oxygen tank on him. And within a few hours, I had to call him back because his oxygen had dropped into the 80s, his oxygen level. And so he went to the hospital, and they put him in some room in the back corner because they had no room for him. And I was talking to him on the phone, and at midnight on Monday night, I got a call from the nurse and said, you need to come get your husband. He's checked himself out. And I was so mad at him. And I was even madder at them that they let him, you know, because I had healthcare. I had his power of attorney for healthcare. And I picked him up, and I remember just yelling at him all the way home. How could you do this? You're so, you know, I yelled at him. And so I had been sleeping in the front room because my niece was really, really sick. And my mom, who was 87, also got COVID. And we thought for sure it would take her, but she lived another couple months and died in a car accident. But Rich just got sicker and sicker. And so Tuesday morning, I called our oldest son, and I said, your dad's not good. He won't go to the hospital. So Randy got on the phone with him and was talking to him. And I called the paramedics again, and they came back and got him. And I didn't know. I had no idea he'd never come home again. Mm-hmm. No. But I think, you know, like you said, Rebecca, I think that I just pushed it out of my mind that he was strong. He was healthy. He was not sick. You know, he was a kid at heart, you know, and he was like the healthiest person I knew. And I never thought that this would get him. I just never did. I believed he'd come home.
Thank you, Leah. What about you, Jennifer? Your thoughts? Because see, we're already starting to see some common threads, right?
Yeah, so a lot of mine was guilt. So he had texted me, and he's like, hey, you know, what do you want to do? It's Friday night. He's like, I want to go out on a date. It was August. We hadn't gone out since basically, you know, COVID. Things were starting to, you know, open up. And that night I sat behind a kid who kept breathing on me, and just, you know, like little kids do. It was the worst dinner we have ever had, ever, ever, ever. And came home, and 2 days later I had a headache, and so I brought it home, and I then got everybody sick. And when Leroy finally was confirmed with COVID, it had already taken him down. He was falling. He couldn't stand up. I didn't realize that those were symptoms of him not being able to get enough oxygen. When, by the time I took him to the hospital, his pulse ox was down to 76, which is massively low. I didn't know this. Nobody talks about these things. And so when he went into the hospital, I wanted to believe he would come out, but, you know, you push everything aside. You know, I've got all this to do. He's going to be fine, just like any other time. You know, just like Leah said, his mother was 87 and had pulled through COVID. I'm like, well, shoot, he's got her genes. There's no way this is going to take him down. He'll be fine. Give him some oxygen. He'll be better in a couple days. And it just, it wasn't the case. And COVID was not one of the things I ever thought would kill him. Cancer, sure. You know, something else, absolutely, but not COVID, not something like this. Not in a million years.
Well, then, like what you've said, all said is, I feel like the education at that time, right, for us was lacking, right? People, the facts weren't out there. I think there was a lot of fear. I mean, I think Rebecca and I think Leah, you guys have kind of said it too, is that whole thing of not coming home, right? It's like your mind, when you're thinking that positive, you kind of think about it for a minute going, they're not going to come home. But then you're kind of like, nope, nope, it's all going to be fine. But I think it was more of that education. And I understand there's a lot of things going on at the healthcare system and all of that too, but the details weren't there for us. Right. I think there was just a lack of sharing that information for us. And then it kind of is tethered to the fact of, I think, again, from a denial, they all got hospitalized, right? Like for my husband, he got hospitalized. I didn't have an opportunity. There was like an isolation type of factor too, and separation. I think all of us probably experienced, because I want to talk about that too. It's, I wasn't able to be there, right? I wasn't able to be there to be his advocate. Right. Especially, again, it's your spouse. You want to be able to hear the medical personnel giving you the updates. So there's like this complete separation. And I think, Rosie, I think your mom was a nurse, right? So she had kind of that healthcare background. So not having that connectedness with all of that was a struggle, right? To even start processing that grief or understanding. So let's talk about a little bit. So I appreciate you sharing your stories, because I think that's what got lost, right? Is people understanding individual stories, but then media and the fear and all of that kind of compounded it, right? It didn't really, I want us to take an opportunity. I think with the work that Rosie's doing too, is our stories are being heard. Our loved ones are being, we're sharing who they were, right? In the midst of all this. But let's talk about like the isolation, because none of us expected them to be hospitalized, right? So then we get into the hospital, then there's those dynamics at play, and in an environment where they were completely on their own, right? It was like, you're contagious, you got COVID, you can't interact with anybody, and they're by themselves. I know they were afraid. I know my husband was afraid. He was afraid of intubation. He was afraid of all that stuff. So how do you feel about that? Do you feel like you were robbed of time to be there, to be their advocate, but also spending time with them? Because little did we know that could be that was our last.
That was it.
Right. Yeah. You want to talk about that?
Yep. That was it. That was it. It's horrible, horrible just to know. And I live in, like, I could probably walk to the hospital. It's probably a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles. And I want to say, first of all, I'm very, very grateful for the St. Joseph's health system that he was in, and it being a faith-based hospital, because they were very, very thorough. The FaceTime calls on the iPad, the updates, I could call, be on hold, and anybody would come answer my questions. I was very involved. My daughter was in nursing school, so we would try to understand every single process that was going on. But it was that feeling should have a new definition of being separated, forcefully separated from him. You know, without, with no way, you know, there should be something for that with not having the right and the capability of being able to see him and help. Because even the simplest thing, like, and the nurses would tell me, so as his oxygen is dropping and alarming, you know, and he's getting delirious and trying to pull stuff out. It takes, like they said, like 90 seconds to put their full, you know, hazmat on. So that's 90 more seconds that, you know, that's there because the nurses can't just run into the room and save him. So it's even worse. I couldn't be there sitting there, you know, or let's say, I mean, we're all married people, no, just to pee, you know. If before he was hooked up to machines, if he's laying there, every time he moved, his oxygen would drop. So then he'd alarm and then they'd come in, what's the matter? Just suit up, you know, 90 seconds. He's like, I just gotta pee until, you know, until he was unconscious. But like if I was sitting there with him all day, I could help him pee, you know, I'm his wife. It's not a big deal. So every single thing that I thought I should be able to do that for him, like I did that at home. Like I helped him with everything. Like he and I were it, the dependency we had on each other, yet the resilience that we had and that he taught me, we had a really big age gap. It's just like I should be there helping him. I should be the one to do all these little things and help the nursing staff, you know, they were overwhelmed and paying so much attention to him, but it was awful, awful. And it was 3 full weeks from the time the paramedics picked him up to when he died. And my daughters and I were stuck in this house, home alone, just going, what's happening? And still in denial, thinking he's gonna turn a corner. He's gonna turn a corner. There was no corner that he turned. I mean, it was horrible, horrible.
I
E
mean,
even in other widow groups, it just when you talk about, and though I've been in some grief share, and they're like, but you know, their husband died of the widowmaker heart attack. She's like, but he died in my arms, you know, or there was a car accident and I ran to the hospital and I was there for him, you know. Unless he died, like there was one lady that her husband died on a fishing trip. You know, she wasn't there, but his friends were there. You know, everyone died. Everyone's the spouses I've been with in this group sharing had someone with them that they knew. You know, and to not have that, oh, it's the worst. I could never. I don't want anybody to ever have to go through that where you cannot be with your loved one, especially my husband. I mean, we were hooked to the hip.
I
Horrible.
think that's what's it's unprecedented, right? What we experience is completely unprecedented, right? And I think that's where there's opportunity for some advocacy and so we have lessons learned, right? What can we do to help others down the road? Because we don't want this to ever happen to folks like us and to our like what happened with our spouses. And what about you, Leah?
So Rich went back in the hospital on the 14th or the 13th, 14th of December. And he was only home for the night. And we talked, you know, FaceTime the best we could with him having that mask on. And on Christmas Eve morning, I woke up and I had a message from him. And he said, I'm going to let them put me on the ventilator. They said a couple of days, and I should be okay. So tell everyone I love them, and I'll see them after I wake up. And I never got to talk to him again. That was about 7 o'clock in the morning because I didn't really sleep. I was constantly on the phone with the nurses when they would answer. Of course, when he went into ICU, it was much better. But Christmas Eve day, I get a call from the doctor, and Rich had only been on the ventilator for a few hours. And this doctor calls me and tells me who he is. And he says, "Will you put your husband on the ventilator today?" And I says, "Yeah." He left me a message and told me. And he goes, "Well, he's not going to make it through the night. So you might want to come say goodbye." Just like that. And I'm like, "But what do you mean he's not going to make it through the night? I just talked to him yesterday, you know." And he says, "Well, I have you cleared to come say goodbye. You and one other person can come in." And I said, "We have a huge family." Nope, only two people." So I got a hold of my stepdaughter, and the girls all decided that she should be the one to go say goodbye, you know. And she went in, she stayed a couple of minutes and left. And then I held the phone for each one of our other five kids to say goodbye to their dad. It was the most heart-wrenching thing I've ever been through at that point, you know. And I came back to the house. They only let me stay a short while, but I was with them, and I got to tell him I loved him, and I'd like to believe he knew I was there. And I came home, and of course I didn't sleep. And Christmas morning, you know, as soon as I could, I called the hospital, and they said that they had transferred him to ICU. He had made it through the night. And so at that point, it was much better to get updates on him. And I later found out that one of our good friends had passed away Christmas Eve night, and Rich had gotten his bed in ICU. On the 6th of January, they called me again and said, we don't know what happened, but your husband's oxygen dropped to 50 and he's not going to make it through the day. And within an hour, a new doctor had called me that I'd been talking to. And he said, there was a kink in the hose. He's fine. Would you like to come in and spend some time with them? And I said, yes. And of course, at 90, you know, dress up and all that, and you walk in the room and you're just sweating. And I got to spend, they let me spend about 10 minutes with them before they kicked me out. And all this time, you know, I'm on the phone with the hospital, with the nurses, with the advocate, doing all that stuff, and then keeping everybody updated. And, you know, that was my purpose for living at that point, was just knowing he was going to be okay. And one day I went out and I was running, and, you know, I heard God tell me he's going to wake up. And so I thought, he's going to wake up. You know, never did I think that it would be on the other side. And on January 12th, I got ready to go to the gym, and I got a call from the nurse and said that Rich had started bleeding from his orifices, and they didn't know what was wrong, but that he wasn't going to make it that day. And so I called all the kids, and we were able to be there. The three girls that lived here, my stepdaughter didn't make it in. My best friend came from the fort to be there. A couple of my son-in-laws were there. You know, when we got to stand around his bed, and he looked awful. You know, they didn't clean him up. They didn't do anything. They just let us come in. And the doctor said, he's bleeding internally. And there's nothing we can do. And so they wanted to turn off the machine. I don't know what's worse. I have friends who, they got the call that their husband had passed, or to be there when that machine went off. And, you know, he took this deep breath, and I just laid my head on his chest and said, you can go, baby, I'll be okay. And then they told me, don't scream or anything, because there's somebody else in the room. And I just collapsed into my youngest daughter's arms, you know, this man that, and, you know, he was the love of my life. And he's gone, you know. And he became a number. He became a stupid statistic in this town. But, you know, we didn't let it in there. So there's happiness with this too, also. But that was the experience of being in the hospital with him, you know. And the doctor who had to sign his death certificate apologized to me. And I told him it wasn't his fault, you know, because it wasn't. You know, the hospital was incapable of doing what they should have done. And they gave him that damn remdesivir. And that's what broke all the capillaries in his body. So.
I appreciate you sharing that, Leah, because it is, as you're highlighting too, he's not a number. I mean, they framed it, again, it's a statistic, but he was a person. He was your loved one, right? And you mentioned like all the rules. It's like every way we turned, there was a rule. You can't do this, you can't do that. You got, like you said, 10 minutes. How do you process all of this when everyone keeps putting these different parameters, right? Our grief, it became traumatic, right? We all have a unique trauma from this experience. We loved them. They were the love of our life. And so to have processing that and say you can't go this way or that way or however, but I appreciate you sharing that.
I'm going to switch over to my iPhone and then
Okay.
head out,
Okay.
meet them, and I'll be back on in a few minutes.
Sure. And then Jennifer, do you want to share anything too, kind of what your experience was there with kind of that just isolation and kind of those last, if you even had an opportunity for a last goodbye as well.
He was in the hospital for 4 weeks. Two of those, he was not intubated. And then the last two, he was intubated. And so the first two, every once in a while, I could get a FaceTime with him. His birthday was a week after he went into the hospital. So that was the first time I saw him. And when I would get those FaceTime videos with him, I would snap screenshots. And so I have those screenshots, and you can almost tell the progression of, I look in his eyes, and his eyes from the first time to the last time I talked to him, it's insane. It's just an emptiness that very last time that I talked to him on the FaceTime. And so when he was intubated, they said that I asked how long he would be intubated, and they said, well, if it's over 3 weeks, he's not going to make it. So that was kind of like my deadline. The day before he would have been under 2 weeks, the doctor called me and said I needed to make a decision. She said, what do you mean a decision? She goes, well, his heart is not going to make it through the night. You need to decide, what you want to do. Do you want to keep him on the machine where basically he'll have a heart attack? Or do you want to stop the machines? And that's a whole nother decision-making process I was not ready to make. And they said, well, if you want to, you can come down, which also included getting a rapid COVID test and trying to find a place to get a COVID test and get an answer within a few minutes. And just nobody talked about that at all, about all the different protocols you have to do just to get and walk in the door when COVID was going on. Get up there, and then of course it's suiting up because you're in the ICU, and it wasn't personal. I mean, I've been there when people have died. I was there when my grandmother died. It was not like that. He's hooked up to all these tubes. You've got people running around looking, like they're in the movie Outbreak because of, all these hazmat suits. And it was just awful, completely awful. Like Leah said, they didn't clean him up. He had been in there for almost 4 weeks. He wasn't shaved. He just looked horrible. And that's when they said, well, you can come in tomorrow, say your final goodbyes. And we were lucky they would let, I want to say, like five people. It was only me and my sister-in-law at the time. I did not let the kids come. I didn't even ask the kids. The kids did not know what was going on. But I've asked them since, and they said they didn't want to be there when he died. So, but just to watch him be unhooked and take his last breath and just holding his hand, and then his heart rate hit zero, and I could feel the blood stop rushing from his hands, and his hand fingertips just tripled. That is just a feeling I'll never get over. Nobody talks about these things at all, ever.
Do you feel, and I think this ties a lot with, I appreciate with what Rosie's doing too, is do you feel like the illness was almost in a sense disrespected, or there's like a loss of dignity to the individual?
100%.
It's almost like discounted, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think is important for our voices to be heard, because that's also what hasn't been talked about. I feel it's just been discounted and falls into this COVID piece, but it's like, it's just the process. What you are all highlighting, these experiences were just so unique, and we need to respect them. We need to respect our loved ones. And it just feels like we just lost all of that, right?
Yep, 100%. Because, well, I've often said this in other discussions. It doesn't matter what race, religion, faith, whatever, culturally in our world, widows are given a certain amount of respect. They're doesn't matter what your religion is, it's everyone says, everyone's faith says, treat the widow as she should be treated, et cetera. So it doesn't matter. I mean, I've come across that just traveling in the world. You know, the widow, once someone, a woman is widowed or widowed period, you know, there's a certain way she should be treated. But we were lump summed. We were lump summed with everyone else. And the statistics are that there's a demographic or an age group of people that died from COVID. And, you know, they say losing a child is unnatural. Losing a spouse is the most difficult thing you'll ever go through. And we're kind of like like just lump summed with, it's not like we're all widows and we all go to a widow group, which we know as Jenny is what you're doing has become a mission is so amazing. But it's like everyone lost someone from COVID. And it's just, we're just put, you know, put all together and it sucks. It doesn't, it's different, you know. It's different as far as being there. Because I had a friend that lost his wife to breast cancer in that same time frame. Well, they still let him come up and see her, you know. But the whole COVID thing was, no, you can't. You can't. We don't have any rules. We don't have nothing. You don't get to see him. You don't get to, you know. And it was just it started this snowball effect that I've seen go on and on. And here we are, 3 years, 4 years later from March 2020, and it's like, no, this the COVID widowed thousands and thousands of people. And it sucks to be part of that because it just, yeah, it's kind of just lump sum together, you know. You know, and I'm grateful we got to be there, but oh man, it's different.
I like that,
Different.
Rebecca. You're transitioning to that. There's a stigma associated with like being a COVID widow. I just feel that there's a stigma to it, right? That there's that judgment. There's almost kind of and it adds to that extra layer of complexity of grief. I mean, I went from a period of time. I would say he died from COVID, and like they would step away from me, and I'm going, "What's? Why are you stepping away? I'm not contagious." I mean, it was just the body language from people that I then started to. I didn't even say it was COVID, because literally on his death certificate it says heart attack. That's the first item, right? So I finally, at a certain point, I shifted away from the COVID and said, "Oh yeah, he passed unexpectedly from a heart attack," because I had a hard time even expressing the COVID because of what I saw other people reacting to that.
And then they ask, oh, what else did he have, you know, what was
Exactly.
his
And how
underlying,
does that
and I hate that.
justify it? That
And
doesn't
I remember
mean,
we talked about that
right?
once. It's like, it doesn't matter, the thinnest guy and the heaviest guy, the diabetic guy, the whatever, the asthma, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. I could have died of pneumonia, my daughter could have died, you know, she was 21. It doesn't matter, we all lost because of that.
Right. And they give that to me, like he had an underline, or if he had this or had that, or again, then it led into the vaccine and all the other pieses. But
I can
And I get it
exercise.
as
Oh.
society is trying to understand. I mean, get it from as an aggregate, everyone was living this experience and it was troubling and traumatic in their own way. But to then get that granular, the stories you all are sharing is, that's not a justification. We lived it, right? And so it was, again, I appreciate you all sharing your stories. Now, let me ask you this too. From all of this, what has been your kind of coping strategies, right? As COVID widows moving forward, type of thing. What have you done from that experience? Having this is again so unique. How have you kind of reframed things to help move forward as other COVID widows might be listening?
I always make sure to talk about him. Like you can ask anybody I work with, I constantly talk about him, because if I don't, he will be forgotten. And that is what I have to do. I have to, when I'm talking to the kids, just yesterday, I'm like, hey, you know, your dad would do this, or your dad said this, or whatever the case is. But I think with COVID, you know, being gone, whatever you want to call it, everybody has forgotten. Oh yeah, he died. Well, it was from COVID. You know, believe what you want, vaccinate, not vaccinate, I don't care. He died. And so I will not stop talking about him just so he's not forgotten.
I almost got in the front seat.
Oh, is that you, Leah?
No. Sorry, I thought I was muted. Let me get myself muted.
So maybe with that, that's a great transition. Oh, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, same thing as Jennifer said, is not, you know, not forgetting, not still saying his name, remembering, reminding everyone, his legacy. I don't know that some days I am coping properly. I don't know what coping properly and living right and healthy and happy is. It's just wake up, I guess, some days and be, you know, I've talked about, I mean, it's a great thing to say, but like my core group of friends from high school, and then my kids' parents, you know, that we've all kind of hung out with these last, you know, that's the parents, sets of parents you get close to your kids' parents. Nobody's divorced. Nobody's widowed. I was 49 when I was widowed, and I love them and I want to hang out and I want to be social, but the silence in the room, the space of air in the room screams at me, your husband died of COVID. Not even that I'm by myself or whatever. It's your husband died of COVID, because mask, no mask. It doesn't matter if I was like, I got to wear a mask for the rest of my life. You know, some people are just committed to that mask forever. It's a reminder instantly. It's a reminder instantly. You know, I had breast cancer once. You see a pink ribbon and I'm like, oh, you know, maybe someone's fighting or they're educated or it's survivable, et cetera. You know, you see it, it's a different kind of memory, but I see a mask and I'm like, oh, yep, that's right. It's COVID. As Jenny knows, 3 weeks later, my uncle, who's very young that I grew up with, he died. 8 weeks later, my grandma died, you know, and you all know how, what kind of funeral you get to have or not have when someone dies from COVID. So yeah, I mean, I think I'll be coping in some form or another and for the rest of my life, you know, and trying not to forget him. I'm so grateful that my daughter had named the new baby, his middle name is David, because I want it. Don't forget David, you know, don't forget David. Because it's important, and respect a different, put have a nice, a different respect, a different type of respect for those of us who lost because of COVID, you know?
So please. That's a good transition. I think Rosie, can you share, first of all, I want to have you also share your mother's name, right? And a memory of her, and then you leading into how you started the Yellow Heart Memorial, because as we've all been saying, we don't want to forget our loved ones, right? You're doing something very powerful that is putting things on the forefront about those who lost a loved one to COVID. And I know, Rebecca, you mentioned the pink ribbon. What Rosie's been doing is that yellow heart, right? To kind of signify that COVID piece. So Rosie, let's hear a little bit about your mom, and then tell us what you're doing with the yellow heart.
Yeah, so it's nice to meet all of you. My name is Rosie Davis. I am the founder of Yellow Heart Memorial. I lost my mother, Mary Castro, very early on. I lost her May 17th, 2020. My mom was in a nursing home, and the last day that I seen my mom alive was on Mother's Day. And 3 days later, she was transported to a local hospital. Again, very early on, they did 3 COVID tests. They were all negative, but because she had symptoms, they isolated her on the COVID floor. They found pneumonia in one lung. Then by the time we got the last COVID test back, which was number 4, and it was positive, she had pneumonia in the other lung. My mom was a DNR. We had a conversation. The doctors wanted to put her on a ventilator, and she refused. So she was just on a BiPAP. Me and her had a normal conversation the day before, and they were going to try convalescent plasma the following day. They gave me a phone call that morning and said, your mom took a turn for the worse last night, and we think that you need to start calling your family. They promised us a FaceTime, which that never happened. Of course, at this time, hospitals were completely shut down, so we could not go to the hospital. My mom passed away before they could even administer the convalescent plasma. And so my mom was one of the first 100 people to die in Dallas County. That's how early it was. And so when my mom died, you know, we were watching this on the news. We were watching it from China. I was watching as Washington State was losing their nursing home residents left and right, and the red flags went up, and I got scared right away, because I thought, you know, my mom is in a nursing home. So when my mom passed away, I was very alone. There was nobody around me that had lost like I had just lost. And so the first thing that I did was I tried to find community. When I lost my mom, there was literally two Facebook groups for COVID. One was in the UK. The other one was COVID-19 law support. So I found them. I joined immediately, and it was just flooded with people from across the world that had lost someone to COVID. But, you know, I learned about the Yellow Heart through the UK group. And I loved that they started to create this symbol, right, that identified us. But for me, it wasn't enough. People would only see that heart. They would know it's COVID related, but they wouldn't know what my mom's name was. They wouldn't know that she was a nurse for 18 years and that she was a single mom. And, you know, just the wonderful person that she was, right? They wouldn't know her story. So I actually adopted the Yellow Heart here in the United States. And I began to put names and dates and messages in those hearts. Little did I know that this would blow up overnight. Literally overnight, I had over 500 requests to put names in hearts, and I created the very first community memorial in Irving, Texas, where my mother passed away, where I lived for 10 years. Excuse me. And so when people seen their loved ones' names, it was like, oh my God, like, there's their name, you know. It was just, the response was just, it was just so overwhelming. And so my plan was just to do the community memorial and go home and then try to learn how to navigate my life without my mother. My mother was my mom and my dad. She was a single mom. And so I lost both of my parents in one day, you know, and that's not what happened. I had so many people reaching out to me and asking me, how do we bring this to our community? How can we memorialize our community just like you did here in Irving, Texas? And so I came up with a way to make packages, and I started sending these out and started helping all of these people across the United States and across, like, globally to set up Yellow Heart memorials. And my mission was to humanize them. My mission was to give them a name and a face, because, like, all of the stories that I've heard today, I refuse to let my mom be referred to as a number. I refuse to let her death be in vain. And I wanted to give her the honor back that was stripped away from her in her death, because, again, very early on, they made us cremate my mom. they did not give us a choice. My mom had a clot already. They said because she was probably still contagious, there was no way we were going to bury her. My mom sat, and these are the details, again, no one talks about. My mom sat in a freezer for a month waiting to get cremated because there was so many people dying. And I just wanted my mom. I wanted my mom. And, you know, me and my mom had had these discussions of what she wanted her funeral to look like. And none of that was done. My family all lived in California. They couldn't get on a plane and come over here. They all had to watch my mom's, what we made a funeral. They had to watch through FaceTime and through Zoom. You know, so there was so many things that were stripped from us as families, the traditional celebrations of life. And so that's what gave me the fuel to make sure that we don't let anybody, I don't care whether you lost somebody or you didn't, we're gonna remember all of these lives that were lost to COVID-19. And launching More Than a Number this past week had a tremendous I mean, it just reached so many people, and we had people fly in from all over the nation. And I've heard so many people tell me and message me and call me and say, Rosie, this right here is what a national monument needs to look like. And I've done the lobbying. I've sat with Senate. I've sat with Congress. You know, I've been flown around the country to meet with governors and lieutenant governors. And, you know, and so the work is far from done. Our community needs so much more. They need mental health services. We have COVID orphans that need financial assistance for the caregivers that are currently taking care of them. We need, you know, we need monuments. We need a lot. And you know, I just got a phone call yesterday. We're getting another permanent memorial placed in Alice, Texas. Unfortunately, I can't travel to make that trip to see the dedication of that memorial. But that's another thing I am working on with cities across the nation, is I'm working with cities to try and establish permanent memorials for our loved ones. So to date, we have 5 permanent memorials. And so that's pretty much the mission. The work that I've been on for 3 years. I'm coming up on 4 years that I've lost my mother. And so, yeah, that's pretty much where my journey has taken me.
And Rosie, I have to say thank you so much. I mean, that what you're saying, everything that fueled you to do the work you're doing, because your recent memorial, you've got a portrait of Keith. And when I saw that picture, like you said, it was powerful. I mean, it just automatically, the minute I saw it, just brought me to tears. And, but it helps us from that grieving standpoint, like you saying, having those permanent memorials, it just symbolizes the love that they had and the life that they had. So I appreciate so much that you're doing, but no, you've got a group of women here. We're advocates, right? You're hearing that theme. We want to make sure that our spouses are not just a number. So whatever we can do to build, like you said, building that community, you started there in Texas, is so important, right? Because that's what we lacked. We didn't have that community. That was all stripped. And you highlighted how it was early on for you. It's like other decisions were made for us. You couldn't have a proper burial for your mother. So all those things. So you had to build that community because that's what helped from that grieving process. So we want to continue to do the work that you're doing. Because it has grown, and let's continue to grow it. Let's continue. And I appreciate, because I understand that advocacy with the local legislators, the national legislators, let's continue that momentum. However we can help you with that, because it does have that ripple effect. You touch upon a whole different area. Here we are, we're talking about COVID widows, but we have children. What about our kids? those they were orphaned, right? You highlighted all that support that's needed for those kids and the mental health
Absolutely.
that goes with it. You are 100% right. By no means is this done. There is so much work that needs to be done. And this is going to be a lifetime. I mean, all of us experience this. We need to take that in memory of all of our loved ones. So I just want to say so thank you so much for leading this effort. And however we can help you, let's do that. Let's
Absolutely.
grow it here in California. You said you got family here. Let's grow it. Let's build something new in California, and all of us will mobilize together and let's get going, because
Well,
it brings us
we
that
actually,
joy for our family, right? For our loved ones. We're honoring them. Just like when I saw that portrait that you had there of my husband, it brought me joy. As much as sadness there's also joy. And let's do this together as a collective group, just us here. So however we can do
Well,
that.
we actually have two of our permanent memorials in California. We have one in Norwalk and we have one in La Puente. So if you're ever out in those areas, please by all means go visit them because they're going to be there forever. So I was actually flown out to both locations and for the dedication. And like I said, we're still working with different cities, and we will have more placed. I'm gonna honor my mom and loved ones that we've lost until my last day. This is our legacy. This is a part of history, whether we like it or not. Future generations need to know about this pandemic that happened. And our government needs to learn from the mistakes that were made while we were all going through all of this whole nightmare, right? And so it's very important that is documented and it's documented correctly.
Well, Rosie, let's get those permanent locations in what, Temecula, Orange, and Visalia and the High Desert. Let's do that.
Absolutely.
Let's
Absolutely.
do
And
that.
I'll make it happen. Just an FYI, ladies. We officially announced that our national walk for COVID this year is going to be in Tucson, Arizona. So that's going to be September the 14th. And if you can make it out, by all means, please do. It's
We'll
going to
be
be a big event. And so if you make the trip, I look forward to meeting you. And like I said, we're just going to keep working until we get all of it, until we get everything done, monuments placed, all of that good stuff.
Well, count us in, Rosie. I think we've got a road trip. And actually, my youngest is in Arizona for school. So guess what? We're going. All right, it's on our
Hop on.
calendar. We'll have to coordinate. Let's get, and however we can work with you, Rosie, to get that word out here, marketing it, all of that. Let's you and I connect, and we'll get the information here to
Absolutely.
this group and certainly get it out. And
Okay.
yeah. So I appreciate all of your time today, because I think the key takeaway is the stories you shared, right? There's a story, there's a loved one behind that story, and those voices that you're, I mean, we need to have our voices out there. As much
Absolutely.
as media switch, can tweak it in their own way, this right here is the core, right here, right? And it's all surrounded about love, community, and honoring and respect. So thank you so much, all of you. I know you're busy in your schedules, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you,
Thanks so
ladies. It was
much.
great to meet you, and thank you for having me on. And like I said, I hope to see you guys and meet you in Tucson
We'll be
this fall.
there. We'll be
Oh
there.
my God.
We're amped up.
All
We're
right.
going.
Awesome.
All right. We'll talk to you
Bye.
soon. Thank you all.